Hello and welcome to Beyond Approaches. This is Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lerzel.
We come to you, well, I come to you from North Canton, Ohio, where I am recording on land belonging to the Kaskaskia Nation.
There you go. And I come to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn today, where I'm recording on land belonging to the Lenape Nation.
All of these nations are some of many still very much out here doing their thing, and we'd like to acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm. That we would.
This is a show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
Uh-huh.
We be drinking and we be swearing.
Fuck yeah.
One of us is slurping the air.
Uh-huh. Just the other us. The sound of drinking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought you were just doing it because I can't.
No, I said fuck yeah, and then I slurped.
Because
we be drinking and swearing.
Got it.
Uh-huh.
Look at you making sense. And me just assuming everything's about me.
I'm just over here being a baddie one shoe.
No. Oh my God. We were just talking off air. I brought up a story that Tux told when I was telling Columbus about ratting on his mother's boyfriend, like blaming him for giving you fireball, right?
Yes, or yeah.
Which he did not do. Yeah, but you just hated him.
Yeah.
I love that story. It tickles my heart. And you're like, I was just a goody two shoes that drank occasionally. And we were talking about why there isn't, you know, a baddie one shoe.
Yeah. Or baddie three shoes. Like, what is having two shoes have to do with being good? It don't make no sense.
Oh, you're so good you have two shoes.
I know.
It's like, isn't that the norm?
Yeah. Whoop-de-doo. Look at you with your two shoes.
I love it.
We'll have to look up the like etymology of where that comes from or what it actually means. It probably means something and nobody even knows. Oh, anyways, today we are drinking a cocktail called a Stinger. The Stinger seems to have originated sometime around the 1890s and may have been a twist on another popular cocktail at the time called the Judge, which was made with brandy, creme de menthe, and simple syrup. The Stinger, however, is basically the same recipe just without the simple syrup. So it's brandy and creme de menthe. The Stinger was immediately popular, especially in New York City when it was first invented, and quickly became known as an upper-class society drink. It was reportedly a favorite of Reginald Vanderbilt in the 1920s.
Ooh, Reggie.
Yes. It is strong, sweet, and minty, and so it makes a perfect after-dinner nightcap. And many people in high society saw the Stinger not as a cocktail, but rather as a digestif, only to be served after dinner. Over time, though, that did change, and people got on board with just drinking Stingers like their cocktails, because it's a cocktail. The Stinger remained popular during Prohibition because creme de menthe helps to mask the flavor of inferior quality brandies that were available during Prohibition, and it remained popular all throughout the 1940s and 50s and 60s when it was mentioned by name in several very popular novels and films at the time. Eventually, though, the Stinger did begin to lose favor in the 1970s, and today most people have never even heard of it. So Stinger recipes can vary quite a bit in proportion, some drinkers preferring a drier version made with less creme de menthe, others preferring it sweeter and mintier. Stinger recipes also typically call for the drink to be shaken, which is actually pretty rare for cocktails that are made from all spirits.
I thought that was weird. I'm like, why am I doing this?
Yeah. Usually if it's
not like frothing anything.
Exactly. Yeah. You would just stir it, but this specifically calls for shaking. They're usually served up in a small cocktail glass, like a Nick and Nora glass, but for an extra refreshing treat, they can also be served over crushed ice like a julep, which actually sounds really good. Like a brandy,
really good. Yeah.
Brandy julep. What was the one? Prescription julep that we loved so much.
Yeah. Oh, it was so good.
Yeah.
It tasted like nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like it tasted like there was no alcohol in it whatsoever.
It was
all alcohol.
Yeah. Sweet and a little minty. But yeah, so the stinger, we will, let's cheers.
I'm scared.
I know. The creme de menthe smells very minty, like mouthwash, but I'm hopeful. I'm not going to be too scared just yet. Oh, that's a pretty glass.
Oh yeah, it's just regular. I tried to. Okay. Oh.
It's good. Hmm. I mean, it's not as minty as it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. It was the aftertaste.
Yeah, there's mint on your tongue afterwards. But it's not like, it does not taste like mouthwash. I could drink that.
Yeah. It tastes like those Andes candies.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'm using a different brand of creme de menthe. But mine doesn't taste that minty.
Mine tastes minty.
Yeah. I mean, it's minty, but it's not like overpowering.
I'm not a huge mint girl.
Yeah. Okay. It's tasty though. I would, you know, I don't know if I would actually.
It's want better to drink than this. I would definitely never order this, but it's better than I was anticipating.
Yeah, apparently they were very popular for a very long time. I could
see having this after a big meal.
Yeah.
If you liked mint.
I've definitely heard them mentioned in like older movies. Mm. I think there's a scene in The Apartment where they're talking about making stingers. So I'm about to tell a story that I have been wanting to talk about for a very long, long time. I'm finally getting around to it. And ooh, I got there.
Exciting.
I got to it by way of Detroit. I'm sure that all of y'all are fully aware by this point that I am now living in Detroit, Michigan. I have been there for about 8 or 9 months. I live in a neighborhood called Virginia Park, which was built between like 1915 and 1920. As sort of a neighborhood of tightly packed brick duplexes for Detroit's growing Jewish middle class. As I've been fixing up the house, I've been discovering all these sort of like pieces of evidence of the neighborhood's former history, including the home's original mezuzahs hidden under layers of lead paint on the like exterior doorways. So Detroit has a really rich, interesting history. And being a history nerd, I decided to do some digging on my new home, do some research. And the more I found, the more I realized, like, this is kind of, I want to talk about all this stuff on the show. Because I'm kind of new to Detroit, part of me feels like, you know, I don't know if this is my story to tell, but it's just the two of us on this show. And neither of us are originally from Detroit. So if the story is going to be told, I'm going to be the one to tell it. So in the 1950s and 60s, as Jewish residents were moving out of my neighborhood to the suburbs, young Black families started buying homes in the neighborhood and the demographics shifted. So the neighborhood became primarily Black. And for a whole laundry list of reasons, the whole city of Detroit eventually became famous for neglect and urban decay as homes across the city were sort of abandoned. And once the roofs failed and windows broke on these homes, the rain and the snow came in and slowly caused many of these homes in the city to sort of crumble in on themselves. My neighborhood is no different. Thankfully, today, many of these homes are being saved and restored by a new crop of young homeowners, many of them gay men, just like me, no children and money to burn. But yeah, Detroit has a very long and
are there Black gays moving in?
Not that I have met yet, but I've only been there for a short time. And okay. I'm like in the house all the time.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, I have definitely met Black gay people, but they're not like new to the area, the ones that I've met.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So Detroit has this sort of long and storied history of boom and bust, racism and rebellion, white flight and urban blight. But thankfully, the city is beginning to thrive once again. Today, the sounds of contractors' saw blades and hammers mix with the sounds of school buses and ice cream trucks and kids playing in the streets. But even still, now that Detroit is sort of on the upswing, this idea that Detroit is this like impoverished ghost town still persists for most people in the world today. They still believe that that's what Detroit is and will always be. So today I wanted to talk about how and why Detroit became this sort of like poster city for urban decay. This is a really big topic. It's a really, really big topic with several different factors at play over several different decades. So I'm going to have to split this story up. Today, I am going to be talking about Detroit's early history leading up to the racist reasons for and devastating effects of redlining and the interstate highway system.
Ooh, okay.
Yes.
Fun times.
Yeah, this is not going to be a particularly fun story, but it is an important story to tell.
I mean, it's the story of every city, every major city.
Absolutely. Yes.
Every single one.
Part of the reason I've wanted to talk about redlining forever, it is a fascinating topic, especially to me. And there's so many different cities that I could have chosen to use as sort of like an example of what redlining is and how it played out. Chicago is sort of quintessentially.
Yeah.
Like,
but literally every city.
North absolutely.
Canton, the bad side of town is the black red line part of town. Like,
yeah,
it absolutely. Is every single city where there's been black people, and not even yes. a lot of black people.
No.
Just draw a line around them.
Yeah, and yeah.
Let exactly. it go into disrepair. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the story of every city, really.
Yes, absolutely. So I would like to propose a toast.
Yes.
Raise a glass to treating people like people.
Ooh, yes. Hear, hear.
Black people, brown people, poor people, Asian people, Native people, gay people, all people deserve to be treated like people. But for most of our nation's history, people weren't people unless they were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants with some money in the bank. So, Detroit was founded by the French as a fur trading hub in the early 1700s. And by the 1860s, Michigan was the center of the country's pine lumber industry. So these huge mansions started popping up just north of the city center in an area called Brush Park. It was basically Detroit's like Millionaire's Row in the 1860s. Mm-hmm. At the turn of the 20th century, just as the lumber boom was beginning to wind down, Detroit transitioned to an industrial economy. And many of these mansions were abandoned and turned into boarding houses for factory workers. These like sort of once impressive monuments to wealth continued to crumble over the years. And by the 1990s, they were so neglected that a bunch of like photographers flocked to Detroit to take pictures in Brush Park and document Detroit's urban decay. The neighborhood is now thriving once again. The few mansions that were still standing have been completely restored and broken up into like really expensive, fancy luxury apartments or condos or whatever. And the whole neighborhood is filled with like new construction townhouses and shops and restaurants. But those images from the 90s of these like crumbling mansions in Detroit from 30 years ago still flash in people's minds when they hear the name Detroit. That's what people think of. So Detroit's industrial economy just happened to be springing up at the very beginning of the Great Migration.
Okay.
Between 1910 and 1920, nearly 500,000 Southern Black Americans moved north.
Fled north.
Yes. Largely because of a combination of crushing social and political oppression and economic peonage in the South and the exploding Northern manufacturing economy. They needed to get the fuck out of Dodge with their lives intact.
Yes.
So in 1910, Detroit's population was less than 500,000 people. But thanks to all these new manufacturing jobs, by 1930, the population had more than tripled to over 1.5 million and growing, making Detroit fourth largest city in the country at the time. You know, during the same period, the city's black population exploded more than sevenfold, from around 5,700 people to almost 41,000, with most of that growth occurring between 1915 and 1920. So in literally in 5 years.
Wow.
Seven times more black people than there were 5 years earlier. At that same time that black Americans were flooding the city, so too were Jewish immigrants coming from Russia, Poland, and Eastern Europe. There were so many Jewish Detroiters, in fact, that the city's main form of organized crime in the 1920s was run by a Jewish mafia group called the Purple Gang, rather than, you know, like the traditional mafia that was happening in New York and Chicago. White collar and elite Jewish Detroiters also served in Michigan politics, both at the city and state level at the time. And all of these new homes, acres and acres and acres of new homes and duplexes and apartment buildings were all being built in like the 1910s and 1920s. And the city showed no signs of slowing down. All of this expansion, all this growth, no one thought that it was ever going to stop. But not surprisingly, both the Black and the Jewish communities in Detroit seemed to be very separated from the rest of the city. Of course, there was a desire for sort of a sense of community and you know, safety in numbers.
Yeah, definitely.
But racism also played a major part in this.
I mean, you could move to the white areas, but they would probably burn your house down.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's like, if you want to keep your house, maybe you live elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, white Detroiters wanted to keep undesirables out of their neighborhoods, which finally brings me to my main topic today. Redlining, yes.
Yes.
You know, this was sort of unofficial segregation up until this point, sort of self-segregation just for safety reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, not exactly self-segregation. That's not entirely what I mean.
Absolutely,
but like
not.
Sort of self-preservation had a lot to do with it, though.
Yeah, I think most humans want to survive.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, but then, you know, redlining changed the game when it came to government-sanctioned segregation.
Yeah.
So we have mentioned redlining on the show several times before, sort of casually bringing it up, and I'm not sure if we've ever officially discussed what it actually means or if everyone, all of our listeners, know what redlining means. So for those of you who don't know, today's for you. Today's for you to learn some things. So first of all, what is redlining? Essentially, it was a way to make sure that the American dream of homeownership was not available to Black Americans. That's pretty much plain and simple. That's what it was. Redlining was born out of government homeownership programs created as part of FDR's New Deal in the 1930s. These programs offered government-insured mortgages for homeowners as a form of federal aid that was designed to prevent a massive wave of foreclosures during the Depression. But as these programs evolved, the government added new parameters for evaluating potential properties and homeowners who would qualify for these programs. Eventually, they adopted a ranking system with color-coded maps based on assumed risk involved in investing in certain areas. Neighborhoods were ranked from A to D, and D areas, which were colored red on official maps, were neighborhoods where property values were most likely to go down and were therefore not worthy of inclusion in these government lending programs and homeownership programs. Government officials used a variety of different factors to determine which neighborhoods were given D ratings, including the age of the homes, the average home values, and neighborhood proximity to industrial areas. But they typically all had one very visible thing in common.
You don't say.
You want to...
In America? Yeah. Racism?
I mean...
Since when?
Yeah, there were Black people there. Shocking. Shocking. Yeah. No one saw that one coming, I'm sure.
I'm glad I was seated for that one.
Yeah, it didn't really matter if a neighborhood was like solidly Black or if it was like a diverse, integrated neighborhood. It didn't fucking matter. If there were Black people there, that whole neighborhood was off the table for people trying to take advantage of federal housing programs. The Federal Housing Administration's underwriting manual made it very clear that, quote, incompatible racial groups should not be permitted to live in the same communities.
Okay.
Yes. Integrated neighborhoods are illegal at this point.
Well, yeah, that's, I mean, it's white supremacy in action. Yeah, you got to separate, because if people are together, they realize that they're just people.
That's,
and we can't have that.
They'll treat people like people. Yeah. an original FHA evaluator report that was discussing the Boyle Heights neighborhood in LA at the time said, quote, "This is a melting pot area and is literally honeycombed with diverse and subversive racial elements.
No.
It is seriously doubted whether there is a single block in the area which does not contain detrimental racial elements. It is hazardous residential territory and is accorded a general medial red grade." Mm. Like, really?
Hazardous.
Hazardous residential territory because of detrimental racial elements.
Oh, God.
Good times, yeah.
I mean, yeah, this is American history. This is why they don't want to teach it, because it's not great, y'all.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. No, this is us.
Yeah.
This is America.
Yeah, and still, like, when Black people just try to sell a home, there's a whole bunch of bullshit with that. Like, we don't make what the house is actually worth.
Yeah.
And we have to have white people stage our homes to get them, like, accurately appraise. Like, it still happens because we don't learn about this.
Yeah.
And yeah, racism just runs so deep here because it's structural.
Yeah. I mean, it's so deeply ingrained in so many.
It's the fabric.
Especially in real estate and housing policy. Like, it is.
I mean, that's how most people build wealth. And, like, Black people aren't supposed to build wealth. Like,
exactly.
It's just supposed to be extracted from us.
Exactly.
We are a resource. Always have been.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. So physical barriers were even sometimes put up between neighborhoods to maintain district boundaries and prevent integration. In 1941, in the 8 Mile area of Detroit.
Build a wall.
Yes, exactly. Yes. One developer had to build a 1 foot thick, 6 foot high concrete wall, a half a mile long, just to get the FHA to approve his plans to build a new white community near an existing Black one.
Wow.
The FHA wouldn't let this man build new homes if he didn't put a wall up to keep out the Black neighborhood that wasn't far from there. So the Detroit 8 Mile wall still stands to this day, but, you know, now the neighborhoods on either side of the wall are majority Black, but it's still there. It's been painted, like, it's been like a community art project essentially to sort of soften it, but it's still like, it's a scar.
Yeah.
You know, between 1930 and 1950, 3 out of 5 homes purchased in the United States were financed by the FHA. But in that period, less than 2% of those loans were ever made to non-white home buyers, which honestly, I was shocked that there was even that less than 2%.
Same.
Like, yeah. I don't know exactly what non-white means there, though, because I don't think they were giving loans to Black people at all, period. You know
what
I
mean? No, they were. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess immigrants, but.
Yeah, maybe like you have Spanish speaking people, Latinx folks, natives.
Yeah. Of course, it didn't take long for
Italians.
Italians. So it didn't take long for private lenders to start using these same sort of maps. It wasn't the exact same maps, but they could see the boundaries that the government was using.
Yeah.
The official government maps were sort of like internal documents that were never really released. But, you know, these private lenders could see the lines, essentially, and use the same lines to build their own maps. And that basically meant that no one, no matter what their race, could ever get loans to buy homes in Black or integrated neighborhoods, whether they wanted to or not. It also meant that Black homebuyers were never able to get mortgages from traditional mainstream banks to buy homes even in their own neighborhoods. So to buy homes, Black people had to go through these like shady loan sharks, essentially, who gouged them on interest rates and often would foreclose on their homes and turn around and rent them out without maintaining them if anyone ever missed a payment. So this also meant that Black people who already owned their own homes in Black neighborhoods weren't able to get home equity lines of credit to make any sort of improvements or repairs on the homes. You know, if a white homeowner in a different neighborhood needed a new roof, or, you know, needed to build a garage or something, they could go to the bank and borrow against the value of their home to get the money they needed to put a new roof on their home. But thanks to redlining, Black people were excluded from the system. So they were never able to do this. And so were white people who lived in redlined neighborhoods. Anyone who lived in a redlined neighborhood, no matter what race, just proximity to Black people was enough.
Yeah.
So most white homeowners, even if they wanted to stay in integrated neighborhoods, were sort of forced out to these sort of lily white suburbs. As years went by, city planners also used redistricting to move unsafe and unhealthy industrial facilities into redlined neighborhoods, making these areas even worse and even more dangerous and toxic for the residents who quite literally weren't allowed to live anywhere else.
Yeah.
Schools, utilities, roads, and other infrastructure projects usually were allowed to sort of just sit and rot in these neighborhoods, were never maintained properly, while city money was funneled instead into maintaining infrastructure in middle-class and wealthy white neighborhoods instead. This, of course, contributed directly to urban blight, and racists would turn around and hold this up against Black people as evidence that Black people liked to live in slums and ghettos. One historian wrote, quote, "The decaying neighborhoods offered seemingly convincing evidence to white homeowners that Blacks were feckless and irresponsible and fueled white fears that Blacks would ruin any neighborhood that they moved into." Hmm. When this is it's a fucking like self-fulfilling prophecy. You said, like, we have to draw a line around the Black people because they fuck up a neighborhood, and then you ruined their neighborhoods for them.
I mean, I mean, that's how you make white supremacy like really real.
It's visible.
You confirm, the biases. Like you create the conditions and then be like, see, look.
Exactly. Yeah. See what you did? Yeah. Why are you hitting yourself?
Yes.
So once like thriving neighborhoods had nowhere to go but down, since the government and the banks and the real estate industry all got together to make sure that no money would ever flow into Black neighborhoods. Money could only flow out into the pockets of absentee landlords and crooked loan sharks who service these redlined districts. Like you said, it's extractive.
It's always, I hope things change, but it's still really bad.
Yeah.
For Black homeowners today in 2022, it's bad. Yeah. Not that bad, as it was back then, but
No, but it's all downstream consequences of how it was back then, because people who were allowed to move out to the suburbs before redlining was finally struck down had a huge jump start on people who weren't allowed to buy homes in these sort of better neighborhoods to build generational wealth and equity in their homes. But, I think a lot of people see these stories in the news about, like what you're saying, the Black families who get their homes appraised for one number and it seems really low, so they have it appraised again by a white neighborhood, take down all the pictures.
Or just trying to buy a home too.
Yeah.
Like going and then getting a higher price and then having a white friend go and it's a lower price.
Mm-hmm.
Like that shit still happens.
Yeah.
But
I think people are seeing these stories today and know that it's happening, but don't really understand why.
Hmm.
So I think this is a really important story to tell for people to wrap their heads around, why is real estate such a racist system?
Yeah. Why are Black people still struggling? Because
exactly.
We still aren't able to accrue the same wealth
100%
as our white peers. And it's it's exhausting, frankly.
Yeah,
but, absolutely. That's why stories like this are so important, because it's not just Detroit. It is literally every single city in America.
Yeah, absolutely.
every single one. It's the same playbook.
Yeah. I'm going to have to split up this, the whole story that I want to tell. I'm going to have to split into two parts. This first story about redlining is sort of I'm just using Detroit as an example. But I could be talking about any city in the country because this was happening everywhere.
Yeah. Close your eyes and point at the map. Yeah. It's the same story.
Yeah. The second story that I'll be telling.
You can tell a Black neighborhood where one used to be is wherever the highway is.
Yes. So
Every single time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm going to be getting into that in a moment. But I think right now it's probably a good time to take a little break.
Yes.
And then we'll talk about the interstate highway system.
Oh, you're coming. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, redlining and interstate highway system go so like hand in hand.
Yeah.
Redlining started first, but, you know, at a point.
Right on the heels.
Yeah, exactly. And they, you know, it was a infinity loop, you know?
Totally.
Yeah. All right. We'll be right back.
Well, hello there. Do you wish your high school history course had more drinking, more swearing, and more ladies?
Well, do we have the show for you. Her Story on the Rocks is a long-form podcast talking about good women, bad women, fictional women, and non-fictional women from all times and places.
Basically, each week we pair two women who we research with a themed signature cocktail.
You won't be sorry you listened to our latest episode.
Available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Cheers.
We're back taking a sip of our Stephanie was calling the saying the cocktail reminds her of eating a peppermint patty.
It does. It's not the cocktail itself, it's the aftertaste.
Yeah.
It is very minty. Like I feel like if I breathed on this mic, it would turn to ice. Like that.
Yeah, totally.
Like it's that
totally
really cheesy 90s graphic.
Yes.
Of like cool
totally. Yeah. Yeah. like icebreaker's gum.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Icebreaker's gum. The 90s had the weirdest gum commercials.
Oh my god. Do you remember like Double Stripe?
What was it? Double Mint? Like the twins and shit? Like
yes, Double Mint. Yeah.
But I do remember Fruit Stripes, the zebra.
The zebra.
Yeah.
And Fruit Stripe gum is so bad.
Love that gum.
It tasted good for 2 seconds.
Yeah, true. Three chews and it was done.
Mm-hmm.
But it was in the garbage. So sweet. Oh, I loved it. Oh, and Juicy Fruit.
Juicy Fruit lasted longer though. Like
Juicy Fruit's so good.
Yeah. All right. I guess we should.
I guess. Stop talking about Juicy Fruit.
We need a break from this story.
Yes. Save me.
Okay.
I'm busy.
I know. Sorry. I have an appointment.
Yes. I'm late for a very important date.
All right. So one thing that a lot of people forget when they discuss redlining is that there were three other color-coded designations on these maps, and at least one more of these designations also negatively affected, you know, other groups in other neighborhoods. We know that areas with Black residents were given D ratings and colored red, but areas that were given C ratings were colored yellow if they had large immigrant populations.
Oh, okay, I'm like, don't say Asian. Don't say fucking Asian.
Yellow.
I'm like, don't do it.
No.
Don't do it.
I mean, it could be Asian, but any immigrants.
Okay.
Any large immigrant population.
I thought it was like the Yellow Power Ranger.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah.
Trash.
Yeah. All a neighborhood needed to be given a C rating was a large immigrant population, especially in areas where most of the immigrants were from the same country of origin.
What does large even mean though?
I mean, that's such an arbitrary thing. You know what I mean?
Like two families, someone brings over their cousin. Is that large? Yeah,
they're like, that's it. No, this is a bad neighborhood now. Time to move. Yeah. Yellow colored C-rated neighborhoods experienced some of the same issues as red line neighborhoods, but definitely not to the same extremes at all. It wasn't like you could never, ever buy a home or get any sort of like equity out of your home if you lived in a yellow neighborhood, but it was definitely harder to buy in a C-rated neighborhood than it was to buy in an A or B neighborhood, for sure. So middle class, non-immigrant, white neighborhoods that were sufficiently segregated from Black neighborhoods were given B ratings and colored blue. And the green colored A ratings were reserved only for the best, wealthiest, and whitest neighborhoods out in the suburbs.
Okay.
Yes. But I love the very specific description of the B-rated middle-class, non-immigrant white neighborhoods that are sufficiently segregated from black neighborhoods.
Wow.
Yes.
Why are they so obsessed with us?
I know. Girl, live your life. Seriously.
Do you.
Yeah.
Have you seen those, that TikTok? It's like, it's like you're never really alone as a black person.
Yeah. There's always like people just staring at you all the time.
Like white people in the background being like, snap.
What is this black person doing?
Yeah. It's like, girl, do your own thing. Yeah, yeah. I'm here, but like, who cares? I'm not looking at you. Like,
yeah.
Mind your business.
Yeah. So when choosing how to grade different neighborhoods on the map, government appraisers used official area description files. And I actually found a few quotes from the area description files that were filled out in Detroit in 1939. In Brush Park, the neighborhood I mentioned at the top of the show that was originally like the Lumber Baron Millionaires Row, they wrote, quote, high foreclosure area, slum area, with infiltration by Negro and Jewish.
Oh, no.
Yes. In Mexican Town, they wrote, quote, heavy concentration, low-grade aliens and undesirable aliens.
Okay.
Yes. In Midtown, they wrote infiltration of Negroes from the East, which I guess a different neighborhood.
Specific.
I know.
Okay. Again, mind your business.
Yeah. My neighborhood that I live in now, Virginia Park, was given a D rating, but that's not surprising at all, considering, you know, I already knew that this had been a black neighborhood. There were black people living here, so we were redlined. But there is a beautiful historic district literally just blocks away from my house. I like it's these like huge stately brick homes, many of them with like slate tile roofs or like Spanish tile roofs. It is incredible over there. And this neighborhood, it's called Boston Edison. This neighborhood was given a C rating, and the files from the government appraisers said that Boston Edison was yellow graded because although wealthier white families still lived there, quote, better element moving out, and quote, there is steady Jewish infiltration.
Mm.
It also noted that, quote, sales difficult because of encroachment of D area, which basically is stating black the folks. Fact that Virginia Park is literal blocks away and there's black people there. So we can't have that.
Infiltration.
Even though the official government maps were sort of classified internal documents, enough people knew what was going on that the term redlining became a very common term used during the civil rights movement, especially in the era leading up to the passage of the Fair Housing Act in 1968. Unfortunately, about a decade before the Fair Housing Act made redlining illegal, the government came up with another fun and creative way to piggyback on the damage that redlining had already done to destroy black neighborhoods and ensure that black Americans wouldn't be able to build equity or generational wealth. President Eisenhower created the U.S. Interstate Highway System in 1956, and infrastructure planners soon were bulldozing their way through black communities already suffering from the effects of redlining. Within the first two decades of highway construction alone, more than 1 million people lost their homes nationwide.
Yeah. What is it? Eminent domain.
Yes. Yeah.
Just taking your shit.
Yeah. It wasn't always eminent domain, but they used it a lot for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not surprisingly, black, poor, and immigrant neighborhoods were much more likely to be bulldozed than affluent white neighborhoods. In many cases, because of explicitly racist decision-making, they chose these neighborhoods basically very, very blatantly as a way to maintain segregated boundaries between black and white neighborhoods. In the years when courts were beginning to strike down the use of racial zoning leading up to the Fair Housing Act, these new highways were often built right over the former boundary lines between segregated neighborhoods. If they couldn't have a wall there, they built a highway instead.
Yeah.
In other cases, The reasons black neighborhoods were carved up was slightly less blatant, but still very much racist.
This is happening in America, in the U.S.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Obviously, yeah. It's very racist.
Basically, highway planners often worked together with city planners to focus on urban renewal.
Oh, yes.
And the idea was basically to get rid of any housing or businesses that were deemed substandard and replace them with attractive new developments and easy commuter routes. Thanks to years of racist housing policy and real estate practices, the neighborhoods with the highest concentration of substandard housing were, of course, communities of color.
What?
Like,
how?
Shocking. I know. No one saw that one coming.
No words.
Breathe. Thanks also to redlining, property within redline districts also was some of the cheapest. was some of the cheapest and easiest to purchase for new highway projects, which allowed planning committees to act like their decisions were financially motivated rather than explicitly racist.
Yes, yes.
They're like, it's just so cheap. Why wouldn't we buy it?
They're just, you know, they're financially savvy.
Yeah.
It's just business. It's not racist business.
They're doing business. What is it?
Business transactions, I believe.
Business transactions. There you go.
Business transactions.
They're just doing business transactions over here. So when highway planners tried to sell these demolition programs to area residents, they often promised them that the old unsafe housing was going to be replaced with new apartments and housing developments. But after black residents were displaced, they usually learned that the new housing that was being built was way too expensive for anyone
for
but white buyers to buy.
That's just what happens. It's like, it's really sad.
Yeah. Even after the Fair Housing Act was passed, when, you know, they legally had to be allowed to buy these homes, they couldn't afford it because the homes that they sold were not worth anything thanks to redlining. So some of these, you know, black home buyers were able to buy into some newly constructed housing projects, but of course they soon found out that these buildings were really shoddily built and very poorly maintained going forward.
Yeah.
But the majority of these displaced black homeowners ended up living within a mile of these new, loud, dirty, polluted superhighways that were being built through their former neighborhoods in homes that were almost no better than the homes that they had already left after being promised that they were going to get new houses. This, like we've said, this was happening all over the country. This was happening everywhere. But Detroit, being the Motor City, meant that there was special emphasis on these like showy examples of what the new highways could look like. Mm. So now the city is filled with these like really big, really wide submerged highways that snake through the city, cutting through some neighborhoods with these very obvious visible scars of where homes and businesses used to stand. But they weren't looking at that. They were looking at like, ooh, this subway or this road is submerged below grade so that like it doesn't create too much noise. And like you don't have to look at the homes that are on either side of the neighbor or of the walls, you know?
Yeah.
The Lodge Expressway cuts through my neighborhood, just four blocks east of my house. You can see where streets and neighborhoods literally just suddenly stop and drop off into these wide, loud ravines and then pick up again on the other side. Just to build this one expressway, the Lodge Expressway, demolition teams leveled 423 homes, 109 businesses, and 22 manufacturing plants.
Wow.
Just for this one road. But neighborhoods like Virginia Park and Boston Edison were lucky to lose just a handful of homes to make way for this expressway. Whereas the Ford Freeway displaced 2,800 buildings, just one highway. And two of Detroit's oldest and most vibrant black neighborhoods were completely bulldozed to build I-75.
Yeah, I mean, that's the story of this country.
Yeah.
Yeah, it happens. Yeah, everywhere.
over and over and over in every city and town and neighborhood across the country.
That's how you know. That's every time you're on a highway, just know that it was a historic black district at some point.
Yeah.
The people's homes were stolen. It's so sad.
Filled with black doctor's offices and drugstores and shops and music venues, Black Bottom was home to 300 black-owned businesses by 1930. It was a vibrant, dense neighborhood just northeast of downtown with a nationally renowned music scene and many famous residents. The somewhat sleepier black neighborhood of Paradise Valley was right next door. And in the 1950s, the all-white Detroit City Council deemed both of these neighborhoods slums and decided to completely level them to build freeways, hospitals, the university, and housing developments. Today, Black Bottom is completely gone. There is not a single structure that still stands from the old neighborhood. Not a single one.
Wow.
All that's there today, besides I-75, are a few now vacant industrial buildings and these like big, wide, empty fields, just grassy fields between highways. That's all that's there.
That's so sad.
Some people in these neighborhoods from, you know, from Paradise Valley and Black Bottom relocated to the housing projects that were built at this time, but many black homeowners bought homes in Virginia Park. Jewish residents were moving to the suburbs, and redlining meant that this was one of the only neighborhoods still standing where black people were allowed to buy homes. So in the blink of an eye, Virginia Park, the neighborhood went from this like middle-class, predominantly Jewish neighborhood to almost exclusively black, dangerously overcrowded, and increasingly poor. All of these new highways didn't just exacerbate white flight. They also meant that urban factories were closing up shops and following their white employees out to the suburbs. So they basically locked generations of black Detroiters out of the middle class and these middle class jobs that they had previously held. So the people that were left in Detroit had, you know, had to find some form of income, but like, you know, they had had good jobs at one point and they were just gone thanks to the highways. So
Everything is by design. Everything has been designed. It's not an accident.
I know. I'm sorry. This is such a hard story.
I mean, it's the story of everywhere though.
Yeah.
It really is. That's why the Midwest is everywhere is so segregated though.
Yeah.
But Detroit is such a black city and it's great that, you know, new people like you are moving in, but it hurts me that there aren't black people moving in.
Yeah, it feels like, you know, the city is very rapidly diversifying.
It's doing that thing that it already did that caused the problem in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. it's like in reverse now. Yeah. No, it feels like the people who live there. I mean, I don't know if new black people are moving in, but I know that black people that currently live there already are leaving. As much as there's a lot of growth and there's a lot of new people moving to the city, the population is still declining every year.
Yeah.
Which is really fucked up. And it's like, but you know, like you said, it's all by design. It's all like people are leaving.
Maybe enough black people will leave that white people will come back in and it'll become a city again.
Yeah. It's weird because it's also like the neighborhoods like downtown, which was formerly like there, all the businesses left, all the offices left. So there were these like huge skyscrapers downtown that were just sitting empty for years.
Wow.
No one was living in them. No one was using them. They were literally just empty. And they've all been, if not already redone and reopened, they're in the process of being fixed up and reopened.
Yeah, that's great.
And, but now, you know, it's, you know, rich white people live downtown.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah. And like I said, Brush Park is like what's left of it. The homes have been split up into these luxury apartment buildings and the vacant lots where the other mansions used to be are just these like really overpriced townhouses.
Yeah.
Like, considering what homes go for in Detroit, I am shocked at how much people are paying to live in Brush Park. It's like, yeah. You know, not quite Brooklyn prices, but not far off either.
But there's, the houses are really big there, though. You're getting a lot these townhouses, of space.
These townhouses, I mean, they're bigger than what you would get as in a townhouse in Brooklyn, but they're still townhouses. They're not huge suburban, you know.
But people are moving in. It's going to be interesting to see what the city is like in like even 5 years.
I mean, I've only been there a very short time, but
I mean, it's good for you. But like, I worry about everyone else there, you know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It does seem like at least the people who are left in Virginia Park, or at least on my street, I don't know a lot of, you know, people, like I said, I'm not really getting a chance to explore because I'm stuck in the house all the time. But the people that I have met on my street have a lot of pride in that neighborhood and are in it for the long haul.
I hope they can stay.
Yeah. But there are, you know, there's, you know, half of the houses on the street have been like flipped in the past couple of years. So there's, you know, but the people who have been there a long time, it seems like they're in it for the long haul.
Yeah.
But they're older. You know what I mean? My neighbor right next door, she's 80 years old.
Yeah. She's not looking to flip a house and like turn a quick buck.
Yeah.
She's there to live in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's sort of the story of redlining that, you know, I
part one.
Yeah. I mean, next time I'm not going to be talking about redlining. I'm going to be continuing to talk about Detroit's decline and the other factors that were at play. The next story that I do will be much more Detroit focused. Like,
what was
Detroit
the thing that you sent me in the chat?
Oh my God. I never had you look at it. It's a map. It's the map of Detroit.
Oh,
the like red, the official.
I'm like, wait, are we wrapping up?
I totally forgot to have you look at that. I forgot that I sent it. It is the official map of Detroit that the FHA.
Oh
like
yeah,
when they split it up yellow into districts. It's most of downtown, like most of the city center, is all yellow and red.
Yeah, yellow and red mostly. Yeah, a little bit of, I guess, blue and green, tiny bit of green.
Yeah. But it's all like the map that you're seeing is Metro Detroit, not just the city. So anything that's like blue or green.
Oh, that's the suburbs.
That's the suburbs.
Oh, so it's like all red and yellow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Like that part down by the river that's solid red.
Yeah.
That's the city.
Whoa.
And the part where it gets a little bit more yellow, a little north
further
of,
out, yeah.
That's like where I live. That's that's like Boston Edison. See how, I don't know, it just north of the city center, there's like one little square of red in a sea of yellow.
Yes.
I don't know. That's my neighborhood.
That. Oh, no
that's
way.
That's Virginia Park, yeah.
Oh, wow. Too many blacks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, so this is sort of only the first half of what happened to Detroit, but obviously I think it's a very important part of the equation of how Detroit became this city that's sort of like known for urban blight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's because the entire city center was redlined. Everyone had to leave.
They did this to themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And this is like the city council was like, nope.
Yeah.
Everyone moved to the suburbs. Get out of here.
Yeah. But again, this happens so many other places.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they're just like, what's, but the city is dying now.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. Urban renewal, interstate highway system, and redlining. It's all like, it's a way to kill a city. It's, you know, you're trying so hard to preserve white supremacy that you killed your own city.
Yeah. Damn. I mean, they didn't know they would kill the city.
No, they didn't know, but they, you know, they made it so bad that like no one wanted to live there. You know what I mean? No one that could afford to leave or was allowed to leave.
Allowed to leave. Yeah. That's, it's just so sad. It's so sad that it had to be this way.
Yeah. So this is obviously a really, really quick and dirty sort of introduction to redlining.
It's a good foundation.
Yeah. If you want to learn more about redlining, because I'm not going to be talking about redlining. I'm going to be talking about sort of the downstream consequences and what happened next for Detroit in my next episode. But if you want to learn more about redlining, there's
like redistricting.
Yeah. There's this really, really good book called The Color of Law.
Oh, yeah. I have that book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have not finished it. It's very dense, and I've been so busy with the house that I haven't had time, much time to read. But yeah, The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein is what I have read so far is like incredible. It's it's heartbreaking, but you know, again, very important stuff to know.
Very important. And it's, yeah, it's dense because this is just the story of this country. There's so many receipts.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's undeniable.
Yeah. They talk about, in the first couple of chapters, he's talking about how federal housing projects and like low income housing used to be very, very diverse when it was first built. These became sort of these like integrated, really sort of progressive neighborhoods in these buildings.
That's how they are in most, like if you leave the country and go to other cities, like that's how it is.
Yeah.
Because it's like lots of people are middle class or lower middle, like working people are in all shades and colors.
Yeah. And these buildings were also like really high quality. You know, they were built by the government and maintained by the government, but they were very high quality buildings and very great places to live. And then all of a sudden, because of redlining, they're like, no, these are for Black people and we're not going to keep maintaining them. All the white people get the fuck out and go move somewhere else.
Unless literally, you people live in squalor.
Yeah. No, but like people were kicked out of their apartments if they lived in these housing projects where Black people lived.
Oh, they were like,
you can't live here anymore if you're white.
That's so crazy. But yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh. Yikes.
Yeah. So I don't want to give away too much information on what I'm going to be talking about next. Yeah,
I'm excited though. This is a really good, a really foundational, really good story that needs to be told.
Yeah.
And I know that you've wanted to do it for so long, but it's.
Yeah. Originally, when I was thinking about doing this, you know, before I moved to Detroit, I'd been planning this for 2 years now. Yeah. I originally planned to talk about Chicago or LA.
Oh, okay. Or
LA, Chicago. Yeah. Chicago is like, but no, Detroit's, you know, it's a mini example of the same thing that was happening everywhere.
Yeah. It's a playbook. It's by, everything is by design.
But yeah, make sure you turn in, you know, again, next month to hear part two. To hear me talk about what happened to Detroit after the highway systems were built and after the courts started striking redlining down, what happened next?
Yeah, how did white supremacy shapeshift?
Exactly.
Stay tuned.
Yeah.
Okay, well that was it was really good. My drink is my drink empty? I guess it's I have like a micro sip. I just wish there wasn't that aftertaste. It's not a bad cocktail. It's just real minty.
Yeah. And at the end, for sure. It does like you drink it and it tastes good. And then you take a breath and it's that like cooling.
Cool air. It's like you just had a menthol cigarette.
Totally. Yeah.
Oh my God. Amazing. So I guess we are done.
Thank God. I don't have to research redlining anymore.
Oh, I know. You are stronger than me because the fact that it's that, like white supremacy is shapeshift and it's still not great for Black Americans when it comes to housing and building wealth. But it is nice to hear where it started. And I knew a little bit of that, but like I learned a lot. So I think everyone's going to really, really enjoy this episode, even though it is a tough subject.
It's not fun. Yeah. This was not a fun episode. I know the first like half of the episode, you just were like,
Well, it's like, cause you're telling a story that's historic, but I'm like current present day.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Come on. Like, totally. I wish I could celebrate and be like, yay. Like
it's over. I mean, that's never the case when we tell stories on this podcast.
Yeah.
I know.
It's all right though. It's like the fact that people are talking about it and like there is sunlight is a disinfectant in some ways, but it's really about getting non-white people in positions of power because white people are just going to be white. Unfortunately. Oh,
absolutely.
So I do think things are getting better and will continue to get better.
Yeah.
And yeah. Yeah, thank you for that story, though.
Yeah.
So America's history is juicy. We just add brandy and creme de menthe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's real, real minty, y'all.
That it is. That it is. You can feel that. Every time I breathe in, it's
good. Like, I just, yeah, it's just, it has a powerful aftertaste.
Yeah.
Very smooth to drink. But like, yeah, it is freshening my breath.
Yes. Totally. Yeah.
So thank you so much for listening to Beyond Approach. This has been Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lerzel.
Thank you to our new editor, Dev. We could not do this without him. Thank you. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Bye, y'all.
1,000 thank yous.
Yes.
And goodbye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Beyond Reproach. Please note we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. A full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a written review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. And make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop on beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We also have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.